A couple of notes to indicate. First of all, there will be an MP3 next week. The material that we're covering today will be on the new one, so there isn't one yet for this, but we were held up a little bit because of trying to determine which of the original tapes to use for the recordings. There are two of them, there are three of them, actually, and there are pluses and minuses with each one. We have to listen rather thoroughly to make some decisions. And actually, for this material today, we only made the decision yesterday. But anyway, those will be made next Thursday, right? And for next week, we're dividing chapter 15 into two parts. And so the material for next week will be the first 20 pages, 456 to 76, the first five sections. And then for the week after, the remaining sections, 6, 7, and 8. All right, so here we are with the chapter 14. I have a rather elaborate interpretation of the first part of chapter 14. I think it's one of the most important things that Lonergan has ever written in terms of his vision of the future of the discipline. And so I'm going to interpret it from that standpoint. And that will take probably the whole first hour of our class. But so I have the summary of that in bold at the beginning of the notes that you picked up when you came in, the summary of that section. That he wants to propose a philosophic method and a method for the future of the discipline that would enable all philosophies to make a contribution to the understanding of the polymorphic possibilities of human consciousness, while also enabling philosophers to sort out what he calls positions from counterpositions. We'll see the meaning of that as we go along. And to disengage genuine discoveries at times from counterpositional formulation. We've already seen him do this with, for instance, the treatment of Freud. Freud's genuine discovery, original discovery, was psychogenic disease. It was expressed in a way that Lonergan would regard as counterpositional. It was expressed in terms of mechanist determinism. But it was a genuine discovery. And so to disengage those genuine discoveries from counterpositional formulations and to do what he calls advancing the positions, advance the positions that you find there, advance the discoveries, push them forward. That's the most important thing to do. Push them forward for all they're worth. On this basis, then, he will propose in this section that the basis of any philosophy lies in its implicit or explicit cognitional theory, which itself necessarily includes some stand on the three basic issues that we've seen in the last three chapters, the real, the subject, and objectivity. So that's the summary, in short, of that first section. So, number one then. Chapter 14 introduces the discussion of metaphysics. But metaphysics is first discussed as part of a far larger program set out in the first section of the chapter, a philosophy of philosophies, a clarification of philosophic pluralism, a resolution of antitheses, and an anticipation also, we can see now in retrospect, of his later notion of dialectic as functional specialty. He wasn't at that stage yet when he wrote Insight. But in Method and Theology, the fourth functional specialty that deals with conflicts is called dialectic. And the issue in dialectic is separating complementary, genetic, and dialectical horizons. So he's moving towards in that direction in this chapter, setting up what later would become a distinct functional specialty in both philosophy and theology and dialectic. My interpretation of all of this is that chapter 17 will come full circle on the proposal that he's making in chapter 14. And the proposal that he's making in this first section governs the rest of the book. So it's a proposal for a philosophy of philosophy. How do we understand philosophic pluralism? What do we do with it? How do we resolve the fundamental antitheses that we find? How do we decide which antitheses are really fundamental? Which of them are complementary? Which of them are genetically related? How do we make those decisions? This is the issue that begins to be discussed here. My own interpretation is that the 17th chapter comes full circle on it and answers those issues pretty setting up the problems at this point. So the first of the philosophical issues that he'll deal with is metaphysics. Metaphysics is the science, the philosophical science, that sets forth the general structure of the objective of the process of inquiry. Being is the objective of the desire to know. Metaphysics sets forth being's general structure, the broad outlines of all there is to be understood. What do I know when I do that? Remember the three basic questions. What am I doing when I'm knowing? Why is doing that, knowing, what do I know when I do that? So this is cognitional theory. What am I doing when I'm knowing? Comes to conclusion in chapter 11. I am the subject of operations of empirical, intelligent, and rational consciousness. And those operations together constitute human knowing. That's what I'm doing when I'm knowing. Why is doing that knowing, chapters 11 and 12, 12 and 13 rather, pardon me, that's epistemology. Why is doing that knowing? Because what I know is being. Being is the real. Being is what, when I know being, I'm being objective. That's why doing that is knowing. So the positions on being and objectivity. Now, what do I know when I do that? Metaphysics presents the broad lines of the answer to that. The details of the answer to that question are provided by the sciences and by common sense. The details are not provided by metaphysics. Metaphysics provides the broad lines of an answer to that question. But the specific details are the different sciences to deal with things in their relations to one another, and common sense to deal with things in their relations to us. So the specifics are provided by science and common sense. The broad lines of an answer to that question are provided by metaphysics. I'm going to just read you, you don't have to look at this, but it's at the end of chapter 16, a quite amazing statement, very brief, in chapter at the end of chapter 16 on page 552. The plain fact is that the world lies in pieces before us and pleads to be put together again. But to be put together not as it stood before, on the careless foundation of assumptions that happen to be unquestioned, but on the strong ground of the possibility of questioning and with full awareness of the range of possible answers. That's what metaphysics will provide. It provides the broad lines that enable an integration of what we already know and an anticipation of an integrated knowledge in the future. But the dramatic situation that's in front of us today because of the fragmentation of knowledge is precisely what he's been putting quite rhetorically. The plain fact is that the world lies in pieces before us and pleads to be put together again. And it's that integration that he's attempting to get at metaphysics in the chapters on metaphysics. All right, the rest of number two I think I've pretty well covered, so we can jump then to number three. Metaphysics, ethics, and theology, all three of them, are derivative from the three basic positions put forth in chapters 11, 12, and 13, from the subject, being, and objectivity. They are the bases derived from them. They are the positions contained in cognitional theory. And then derived from them will be metaphysics first, then ethics, chapter 18, and theology in its philosophical form, chapter 19, and then it opens in chapter 20 onto the possibility of a theology that is more than philosophical. So ethics and theology have other bases or foundations besides cognitional theory. But in Lonergan's later terms, intellectual conversion, which is what he's been doing, this is what he's been trying to bring us to up to this point, is intellectual conversion. Intellectual conversion will be part of the foundational reality for ethics and theology. But there will also be moral conversion, which of course will be very important for ethics, and religious conversion, which is the basis of all of them and is the most radical foundation for theology, for the foundation of reality of theology. But this is intellectual conversion, answering these questions. But he would maintain if you can answer them basically along the lines of, that he's pointing out, that's exactly what he means by intellectual conversion. And it is a conversion because it's a movement away from the spontaneous assumption that what I'm doing when I'm knowing is taking a good look at all what's already out there now. Knowing is a lot more than that. Knowing is raising all the further relevant questions and answering. So metaphysics and in part ethics and theology are derivative from cognitional theory, what am I doing when I'm knowing, from epistemology, why is doing that knowing. Metaphysics asks and answers the question, what do I know when I do that? And the question, not made explicit here in this chapter, but definitely latent, the further question, what do I do? Is the way I've expressed it in some of my things is there's another question here, and he's doing this in this chapter, although he doesn't. What do I do when I know all this? Praxis of meaning, the reorientation and integration of the sciences and common sense. That's what I do. That's the intellectual vocation, if you want, of the philosopher and the theologian. Part of it, at least, is the reorientation of contemporary science and contemporary common sense on the basis of answering these questions. So you can raise a further question. He's definitely pointing in that direction when he speaks of implementing. Implementing is a matter of reorienting and integrating the sciences and common sense. I've got a lot of this. I don't know if you want to look further into this, but in a book called Psychic Conversion and Theological Foundations, in 1981, I think, published by Scholars Press. It's out of print right now. I have the opportunity to bring it back and get to. An issue there of trying to take this and to reorient the science of depth psychology on the basis of what Lonergan has provided. So it's one indication of the reorientation and integrating of that dimension of science. There's some of it in theology. There's a lot of it in theology in the Dialectics of History, as a matter of fact. And especially in the chapter on Jung, chapter 10, where this is as far as you can go with Jung. You can go very far with him on the basis of these positions and these things. But then there comes a certain point where there's a little shift that has to take place. That's the argument that I'm doing there. But anyway, what do I know? What do I do when I know all that? When I've answered these three basic questions, the praxis element of metaphysics. What I do is to implement what I've come to know by engaging in interdisciplinary collaboration, to reorient, integrate, and develop contemporary science and the various forms of common sense. This is a task that has barely begun. It's a program set out by Lonergan that it is time to begin. At the Lonergan Research Institute, when we talk about what we're doing over there, we talk about preserving and promoting his work, like the collected works, the tapes, so on and so forth, the CDs, but then also developing and implementing. And that's what we have to begin to do a lot more of. Developing and implementing the work. But that's what he's calling and pushing for right in this chapter. So in this sense, then, metaphysics provides a basic or general semantics for doing this, for reorienting and integrating the contemporary sciences. All right, so the chapter begins by discussing an underlying problem peculiar to all philosophy, ethics, theology, human science. Namely, he doesn't put it this way here, but he puts it precisely this way in some of his other lectures. Why is it that when you've got a development in mathematics, or a development in natural science, in physics, or in chemistry, there'll be a little bit of resistance for a while, but eventually the evidence will be so obvious that the scientific community will go along with the development. But in philosophy, in ethics, in theology, in the human sciences, the fundamental differences remain. Disagreement doesn't go away, even when you've got developments that take place. The fundamental disagreements don't go away. We can even say today that in philosophy, we can go back to Greek philosophy and find certain parallels to the differences that we have in our own time. We can find people tending in idealistic directions, people tending in nihilistic directions, people tending in realistic directions, all right? And they're completely different languages, you know, from what are the languages of the philosophers today, but those same tendencies are there, they remain. And Lonergan's answer to it is because the knowing subject in those disciplines is existentially engaged in a way that is not true in mathematics or in physics or in chemistry. Your life is on the line in a way that it is not when you're working as a mathematician or a physicist or a chemist. Your very integrity as a subject, what kind of subject you want to be, is at stake in philosophy, in theology, in ethics, in human science, psychology, sociology, economics. There are issues of personal authenticity or integrity that are there. And so the subject is engaged in an existential manner that is not the case in mathematics or physics. And so that's why the resistance in mathematics or physics is a very short lasting resistance to new discoveries, because the evidence comes in and people move on. Right? This is it. This is a new development. This is the community agrees. And there's a general agreement in the community that we're not going to go back on Einstein. We might go forward from him, but we're not going to go back on him. But there was resistance, I think, just by Einstein some time back. And the biography is called E equals MC squared, the history of equation. And there was tremendous resistance at first, because, I mean, who is this guy? He doesn't have a teaching position. He's a mail clerk. And all of a sudden, he gets this article published, and everybody's talking about it. A lot of the professors, who, you know, you have to have footnotes in the right place, or otherwise nobody's going to pay attention to you. They poo-pooed him because of that, but it didn't last long. And it caught on because of the implications were astounding. It all seemed to be verified. The more people would experiment with it, and so on and so forth. But that doesn't happen in the other fields. There's a whole tradition, a trajectory of development in philosophy, but then there's always the other tendencies to go away from, and then there's a way in which those other tendencies can be brought into making contributions to a line of development. But then who am I to determine the line of development? You might determine that there's a completely different line of development. And so ultimately we have to meet on a basis of, what is human knowing? What is worthwhile behavior? Perhaps, and certainly in theology, what is an authentic religious stance? And those are the fundamental issues. Those are the basic issues. And that's why he'll say in theology, it's intellectual, moral, and religious conversion that are the ultimate foundation of reality. But then, he's got his own idea of what those are, and somebody else might say, well, that's not intellectual conversion at all, that's error. Those are the areas where the fundamental antitheses are played out. The basic issue then could be put this way. What kind of self are you going to affirm? The self-affirmation of the knower is part of the self-affirmation that Lonergan wants to bring you to. It's not all of it, but it's a big part of it. Well, are you going to affirm that kind of self? A self who is capable of self-transcendent knowing activity, that in certain instances, by pursuing all the further relevant questions, can reach what is. That's critical realism. Is that the kind of self you're going to affirm, or not? It's a question implicit in all of these disciplines. Among the objects of these sciences is the subject. That's not true of physics, except in a very, very remote fashion. But the subject, and the subject in his or her integrity and authenticity. So the positions taken in philosophy, in theology, in human science, always have an existential significance for the subject doing the science. And in many instances, we settle for too little. That's one of the real problems. We settle for too little. Perhaps we really are capable of knowing what is. Perhaps we really are capable of choosing values, genuine values. Perhaps we really are capable of companionship with God. But there's always other tendencies that will lead us away from that, from any one of those. And so what he's doing in the first part of this, and what he's doing throughout his work, is really making that crucial question explicit. The way he puts it here is the underlying problem is the problem of the polymorphism of human consciousness. And that polymorphism, that how our consciousness can take on different forms, that's a complex function of several factors. The radical duality of human knowing, that, yeah, I do know this way. That's genuine knowing. But it's not the full human knowing. I know something by bumping into that. I do. But then there's that full, rich human knowing that is a matter of starting with this and moving on to an understanding, perhaps even theoretical understanding of things in relation to one another. There's the uncritical survival of the first kind of knowing, even in relatively cultured consciousness. Even when people are called upon to give an account of what it is that they're doing, they'll start to think in terms of some kind of visual or tactile contact with what's already out there. There are the various patterns of experience, all of which have their valid role in human living. There's the radical question of the presence and absence of authenticity on the part of the knowing subjects. That is the radical issue, the most serious of the underlying problems. The others can be dealt with in less drastic fashion. But why are the philosophies so disparate? Because consciousness is polymorphic. It flows in different forms, in different patterns. The patterns alternate, blend, mix. This is practically a quotation. They can interfere with each other. They can conflict. They can lose their way. They can break down. And above all, because there are radical dialectical differences on the questions of knowing, being, and objectivity, because there are radical dialectical differences in ethical stances, and because there are radical dialectical differences in religious orientations. And so to go to the root of the philosophic differences, one has to penetrate to these levels. The fundamental issue of what am I doing when I'm knowing? What am I doing when I'm setting my values? What am I doing when I'm involved with questions of ultimacy? What's going on? Three basic positions are adopted. These three basic positions. What am I doing when I'm knowing? Why is doing that knowing? What do I know when I do that? They are adopted in the intellectual pattern of experience. No one lives in the intellectual pattern of experience. And you wouldn't live long if you tried to stay there exclusively. Because you would forget about eating, you forget about a lot of other things. Okay? We don't live in that pattern. We move into it to solve certain kinds of problems. But other patterns might introduce radically different views on the self, on being, and on objectivity. And they will do that, especially if they're governed by radically different moral and religious stances. So he's not yet discussing the religious and ethical components because he's moving from below upwards. He'll bring them in later. The last three chapters of the book, but they do have a tremendous influence on the kind of orientation that we take philosophically. Let me take number five, and then perhaps we could pause just to make sure that we wouldn't care. The main block to authentic philosophic performance, considered precisely within the philosophic framework and independently of the religious and moral, is the duality of human knowledge itself. In other words, the main if you wanted to set up the main contrasts in philosophy, it would be something like this. On the one hand, the unquestioning orientation of extroverted biological consciousness. What I'm doing when I'm knowing is taking a good look at what's already out there now, just the way the cat takes a good look when we go by the pet shop, you know? That's the cat's knowing. Right? Vitally anticipating and already out there now, that's one side. And on the other side, objectivity as the fruit of intelligent inquiry and critical reflection. So that, for him, would be the basic issue in the philosophic pluralism, at least up to this point in the book. This is something of an extreme contrast. No philosopher could actually reasonably, intelligently, and reasonably continue to defend that human knowing is no more than the knowing of a cat. The problem is much more nuanced. There's the uncritical survival of that assumption in a lot of different philosophies. For instance, the naive realism of an Etienne Gilson, who believes in God, who is definitely morally oriented, but yet at the same time can't give a critical account of a lot of these issues because he really does believe that the first thing is that by touching this, I know what is real as real. I don't. I only know that when I get to judgment. I don't know it is real. I just feel it. That's all. And that's not knowing it is real. So, are we okay up to this point? Following the meditation. Right. The duality makes it possible then, the duality of this orientation. So, that objectivity as taking a good look, or objectivity as the fruit of authentic subjectivity. Radical difference there. Makes it possible that in contrast to each of his basic positions, Larrikin can set sharp antitheses that result from the perduring influence of the already of the now mentality. So, and I'm quoting from page 410 here, on the question of objectivity. Against the objectivity that's based on intelligent inquiry and critical reflection, which is the position that he defended in chapter 13, there stands the unquestioning orientation of extroverted biological consciousness and its uncritical survival, not only in dramatic and practical living, where sometimes it's very useful, but also in much of philosophic thought, where it always introduces confusion. On the question of being, against the concrete universe of being, of all that can be intelligently grasped and reasonably affirmed, that's the position, there stands in a prior completeness the world of sense, in which the real and the apparent are subdivisions within a vitally anticipated already out there now. So the real, well, it has to be real, you feel it. But how do you know it's not really an illusion? How do you know it's not just appearance? The real and the apparent are subdivisions within the vitally anticipated already out there now. This begins, the word should be begins there. This begins a set. At this point, Lonergan has begun to identify the real with being. Okay? Being is the objective of the pure desire to know. Being is what is known by intelligent inquiry and critical reflection. Now, being is the real. That's the real. The real is what is known by raising and answering questions for intelligence and questions for reflection. And then the biggest one is the difference on the subject, because we all do, because we live in dramatic and practical experiences, because we suffer, because we have pain, and so on and so forth. We can sometimes tend to think that that's nothing, but that that's all that we are. So against the self-affirmation of a consciousness that at once is empirical, intellectual, and rational, and we can go on, and moral and religious, there stands the native bewilderment. We all know what that is, the existential subject. What am I to make out of my life? I don't want to be just. There's something more. I'm revolted by mere animality. Unsure of his way through the maze of philosophies. Trying to live without a known purpose. Suffering despite an unmotivated will. Threatened with inevitable death, and before death with disease and even insanity. That's all a human possibility for all of us. We know that. It can overwhelm us, it can overcome us sometimes. The issue is that all there is? Is that all there is? Is that all there is? Or is there something more? Again, the ground of the antitheses is the polymorphism of consciousness. One has to be in the intellectual pattern, or one has to be influenced by it to affirm these basic positions. But we don't live in it, and that's the problem. But when, it's a problem in one sense, and in another sense, it's a good thing that we don't live in it, because for a lot of issues, what we have to call upon is our practicality or our dramatic artistry or whatever, not the theoretical. But these antitheses reflect, and this is language that he uses in later works, drawing on Heidegger, the Sorge, the concern, the care, of other patterns not yet transformed to match the reach of the notion of being. And he's got a very interesting statement in Topics in Education, the lectures on education that he gave in 1959. The transformation of the other patterns up onto the complete openness to being that he's already spoken about in these chapters, the transformation of the other patterns, so that in my day-to-day living, I am as completely open
as the notion of being is given only by way of the supernatural gift of charity. God's love is poured forth into our hearts, opening us upon the realm of being, the universe of being. It is by charity that we can move into the practical pattern of experience without contracting our horizon. Quotation from page 91 of Topics in Education. So there you see the relationship between this natural knowledge and the supernatural. But it is only through the gift of grace that we can live this, not just know it, but live it. We can live in the universe of being and not just be confined to a habitat where we have to pursue our desires and avoid our fears. But this life is based much more than that. So this is a very existential thing that he's doing. It's profoundly significant for who we claim that we want to be, what we want our identity. The philosophies then are many, contradictory, and disparate, because the ground of philosophy is the human mind, the mind of the philosopher. And the human mind is a polymorphic reality. It is a manifold of patterns and tendencies. It's a blend of two forms of knowing. It's a bewildering fact prior to all clear antitheses. It's a struggle between authenticity and inauthenticity. The mind, basically, the mind can be a mess. It can be this polymorphic reality, some of which is just different patterns, and that can be harmless if you can move from one to the other with relative ease. But then there's all this struggle between what's genuine and what's really authentic and what isn't. That's the real issue. The clear antitheses could be formulated only on the basis of the turn to the subject. No one prior to Descartes, Kant, and all of that sort of thing could put the formulation as clearly as he's done here. Aquinas couldn't do it. Aquinas has got what Lonergan would regard as the positions on these issues, but at the same time, he couldn't formulate the antitheses this way because there wasn't this examination. What am I doing when I'm knowing? Aquinas had little insights into it. He never developed a full cognition. He couldn't because the question wasn't alive like that at this time. So we needed this bit to turn to the subject. But now we've had it, the mind can gain some mastery, some knowledge, at least, of its own manifold. And determine, this is Lonergan's language, and I'll explain in a moment what I think he means by it. Determine what utterance is, the outer word, what is uttered, namely our insights and judgments, issuing into inner words, and what's the relation between the two. And what he means by that is that we can determine whether there is performative consistency between what we say and what we know, and between what we say and how we know. Is what I claim performatively consistent with what I've affirmed that I am when I say I am a unity, identity, whole constituted by operations of experiencing, understanding, and judging? Are my philosophic claims consistent with that, performatively, or is there an inconsistency? So the complexity of the mind is at the root of the antithetical solutions. And now here's the beautiful thing that you could learn in this. The philosophical ecumenism of the world. All the many contradictory disparate philosophies can all be contributions to the clarification of the fundamental issue of the polymorphism of human consciousness. There's something to be learned from every philosophy. Every philosophy can be mined for what it has to contribute to our understanding of the polymorphic reality that is the human mind. Clearest examples of this in his work, we've seen it with Freud already, okay? The genuine discovery there of psychogenic disease pushed that, advanced for all its worth. Lonergan, other times, gives the example of Hume. For Hume, all human knowledge is just a matter of sense impressions linked together by habit and custom. Now that, for Lonergan, would not be an adequate answer to this question. What am I doing while I'm knowing? But there's an incredible amount of detail about sensations linked together by habits and custom that can give you a tremendous amount of data with regard to at least the first level of experience. And you learn that from him. You, even though you negate, you can't affirm that that's all that human knowing is, he's got a tremendous amount to contribute to the fullness of the understanding of the answer to that question, because he's got the details on how our sense impressions do get linked together by habit and custom. And that's the whole way in which our sensitive orientations are set for us to receive the patterns, to receive the data that come in. So that's just one instance of how, what he's saying here, how all of the many contradictory disparate philosophies can all be contributions to the clarification of the polymorphism of the human mind. And that clarification then for him is the systematic goal of philosophy. That's the aim of philosophy, clarification of the polymorphism of Dasein, of the human, of human consciousness. In chapter 17 of this book, it will issue in an ontology of philosophic meaning. And my interpretation, though, the interpretation has to be quite confident that I'm correct on that. All philosophers and all philosophies are instances and products of inquiring intelligence and reflecting reasonableness, as these are either correctly or incorrectly engaged in and understood. So there's a unity of origin to all philosophy, the polymorphic consciousness of human subjects, and there's a unification of goal, a unity of the goal, clarifying that polymorphism. And that, so that any given philosophy can have a significance that the philosopher might not have suspected, and can make a permanent contribution to our self-understanding. All philosophies then can be viewed as contributions, however contradictory, to a single goal, the clarification of this polymorphic fact. So that's the ecumenism, the philosophic ecumenism. It's an ecumenism that is reaching towards what I think is the same thing with Christian ecumenism. Today was an entirely different thing, but we're reaching towards a unity that we've never had before. We can't go back to one that we had before. That's a mistake. We're moving ahead to a unity that's never existed. And the same thing is true with this vision of philosophy and philosophic disparateness. We're moving ahead to a unity. We're not going back to a position. Wouldn't it be nice if we could go back to Thomas Aquinas and forget all the stuff that's happened since then? No, we can't. It's ridiculous. You have to move on. You have to go ahead. You'll bring a lot of Aquinas with you, but you've got to go ahead. You can't go back. So the method of philosophy thus conceived entails in part tracing the utterances of other philosophers, what they say, their outer word, to what is uttered, what are their insights, what are their judgments, and discovering whether that inner word is or is not compatible with the activities of grasping and intelligence and affirming and reason. And if not, then what is the genuine discovery there? I should have added that in the notes because that's one of his points. There's a genuine discovery in any philosophical book. And I know from my own, you can see it with modern and with the immense amount of literature that he quotes, not in Insight, but almost everywhere else. But he did a tremendous amount of reading, and his whole orientation in every book that he picked up was, I'm going to learn something from this. It wasn't, I'm going to attack it, I'm going to criticize it, I'm going to learn something from it. That's the first thing. What is the insight? And he mentioned to somebody once, how do you read a book? Somebody said, how do you read a book? And he said, go for the insights, withhold your judgments. Okay? What are the insights that are being expressed in the book? That's the first thing. And withhold your judgments until you're sure that you got that. It's the great books program. What does the person say? What does that person mean? And only then, what's my judgment? But what's the insight? So the dialectical program in the service of an ecumenical goal, discover a unity of origin and of goal in philosophic activities. The unity of origin, again, the polymorphic human consciousness, the unity of goal, the clarification of that polymorphic fact. In this way, every philosophy will be discovered to have a significance that can extend beyond the philosopher's horizon, and even in a manner the philosopher did not expect, pertain to the permanent development of the human mind. So contradictory contributions can be made to the single goal, an illumination of the polymorphic orientations of human consciousness and the implications for our thinking, our living, and our world. Are we okay to that point? Any questions? Any problems? See what I'm saying? As I say, it's an elaborate interpretation of part one of the chapter, but I know that it's mentality, and I think it's a great way to
great deal of what he really is expressing.
The achievement of that complex goal depends on both direct and inverse insights. Inverse insight in philosophy is a matter of grasping that a given position is incompatible with the activities of grasping it intelligently and affirming it reasonably. So, for instance, if again draws on the example of Hume here, that if you say all of this, if Hume says all of human knowing is nothing but sensations linked together by habit and custom, but then you read Hume and you see that there's a tremendous amount of creative insight, and that can't be accounted for by his position. He can't account for what he's doing. He's displaying creative insight, and he says all of it is just nothing but sensations linked together by habit and custom. Well, sensations linked by habit and custom are not created. They're given to us, and we have a lot of them. But the creative insight is something that he's not accounting for. That's what he means by saying that a given position is incompatible with the activity of grasping it intelligently and affirming it reasonably. Such a position is really a counterposition, and that's what he means by that, because it runs counter to the spontaneities through which it could be intelligently grasped and reasonably affirmed. It originates somewhere other than in the notion of being, which is experience, understanding, judgment heading towards the real. Somewhere other than in intelligent and reasonable anticipation of what is. From some other dimension that doesn't have a criterion for ascertaining what is true. Why is it that we are so stuck in this naive realism, or the real is what's already out there now? Well, part of it is because we are fearful animals. That's part of who we are. And we need the vital, biological extroversion to what's already out there now. We need it for our survival. We have to have that. And that's why we cling to that. But to cling to it philosophically is what gets us into trouble. Not to cling to it in our lives. There are times when it's exactly what we want. But you can't be just a fearful animal if you're trying to cling to philosophy. You have to be an intelligent and reasonable human being. So it originates somewhere other, for instance, in that the fear of the animal part of us, or the insecurity that we have. We know how insecure, how precarious our existence is. We know that. If we were very close to an accident that had, if it had happened, would have killed you, you know that. You know how precarious it is. So direct insight, on the other hand, will grasp that there are also positions. There are utterances, outer words, philosophic utterances, that are compatible with the activities of intelligent grasp and reasonable affirmation. So the heuristic principle through which philosophy develops and approaches the goal of grasping the polymorphism of human consciousness is this. Positions invite developments, and counterpositions invite reversal. But notice this now. There are positions that are contained in counterpositional formulation. And that's the thing, is to try to find those. It's like Freud's psychogenic disease is a position contained in a counterpositional formulation that it's all matter in motion, mechanist determinism. Genuine position is contained there. To disengage that position and then advance it, develop it because it invites development. So even the reversal of the counterpositions then will contribute to the ulterior goal of clarifying the polymorphism of human consciousness. And that's all explained on 4.12.13, which we won't look at because I've got that right in the next number here. And it marks the turning point in the book. And it used to be with the old edition that when you turned a page, you came to the turning point in the whole book. Well, unfortunately, this doesn't work that way. But it used to be you turned from 387 to 388, and there it was, the turning point. But a turning point in the whole book, the culmination of these three chapters on the basic positions, and the beginning of the implementation and the construction of a consistent worldview. So the 6 points on 4, 12, 13, I'm summarizing in number 12. So we don't have to look at 4, 12, and 13. We can look at number 12 here, and that would be the summary of these. And this is the turning point in the book. First of all, distinguish in any philosophy between its basis in cognitional theory. What am I doing when I'm going? Ultimate basic philosophical. And the expansion into metaphysics, ethics, and theology.
That's the first thing. So disengage the implicit or explicit cognition of fear. Two, distinguish two aspects to the basis. What can be determined by an appeal to the data of consciousness? That's what he did in chapter 11. I am a unity, identity, whole of the performing the operations of seeing, hearing, touching, touching, tasting, smelling, inquiring, imagining, acquiring, understanding, formulating, conceiving, uttering, reflecting, grasping the evidence, judging. Okay, all of that by appeal to the data of consciousness. That's part of it. And then also in cognitional theory, there will be some stand on basic issues without which the formulation of the theory cannot be complete. Those basic issues have to do with the real. With the real, chapter 12, with objectivity and with the subject. Four, formulate the basic positions and the basic counterpositions. And here we will. I will look at page 413, paragraph that begins thirdly. Thirdly, the inevitable philosophic component imminent in the formulation of cognitional theory will be either a basic position or else a basic counterposition. By basic here, he means fundamental. He means foundational. But he means foundational in the sense of what we'll see, what we already saw actually in chapter 11, as a pragmatic foundation. Okay? It can be formulated in a number of different ways. That's not that you've got to have a consistent formulation, but one that is sort of the first principle from which you deduce other things. It will be a basic position if, one, the real is the concrete universe of being and not a subdivision of the already out there now. If by the real you mean what can be intelligently grasped and reasonably inferred, not what I see when I take a good look, but rather what can be intelligently grasped and reasonably inferred. Secondly, if the subject becomes known when you or I affirm ourselves intelligently and reasonably. And so we are not yet known in any prior existential state by just feeling. And even Carl Rogers' psychotherapy would back this up. People feel, but they don't know what they feel. And there has to be a way of getting them to articulate what it is. It's just conscious, but it's not known until there's some kind of reflection, intelligent grasp, and reasonable affirmation. Yes, this is what I'm feeling, and this is why. And thirdly, if objectivity is conceived as a consequence of intelligent inquiry and critical reflection, not as a property of vital anticipation, extroversion, and satisfaction. Those are the three basic positions. On the real is what can be intelligently grasped and reasonably affirmed. The subject is what I can say about myself by grasping it intelligently and reasonably, part of which is that I'm a knower, part of which would be any other intelligent and reasonable judgment that I can make about myself. And objectivity is a consequence of authentic subjectivity, a consequence of intelligent inquiry and critical reflection. The three basic positions in philosophy for him. Root the next paragraph, it will be a basic counterposition if it contradicts one or more of the basic positions. Fifthly, root the derived positions and counterpositions in the basis. So root the metaphysics, the ethics, the theology in the basis. So I'll read paragraph fourthly here. Any philosophic pronouncement on any epistemological, metaphysical, ethical, or theological issue will be named a position if it is coherent with the basic positions on the real, on knowing, and on objectivity. It will be named a counterposition if it is coherent with one or more of the basic counterpositions. What makes a statement a counterposition then that it is incoherent with the activities of grasping it intelligently and affirming it reasonably? For those activities contain, in themselves, as I perform them, they contain the basic positions. So all positions invite development because they're coherent with intelligence and reasonableness, and all counterpositions invite reversal because they're not coherent. What would result from following through on this and reading any philosopher? You would be able to find significant discoveries even in counterpositions. You would be able to separate the discovery from its accompanying bias or mistake or error or oversight or whatever.
who would be able to reverse the counterpositional part and develop the discovery, as Lonergan did with Freud in chapter 6. He would be able to develop the sequence of discoveries expressed by positions into a unified cumulative structure, adding the positions initially expressed in counterpositional terms. And that's an overall program of vision, and it's really quite a panoramic vision for philosophy that he's introducing in this chapter. In addition, of course, to philosophy's perennial metaphysical, ethical, and theological tasks, but we're dealing with philosophical pluralism. Okay, I will take the 13 and 14, and then we can take our break. To say that the three positions articulated here on the real, the subject, and objectivity are the basic positions is to say that all other positions in philosophy are derivative from them. Just as in theology, to say that intellectual conversion, which is those three positions, moral conversion and religious conversion, are the basic foundational realities, is to say that all theological statements are derivative from intellectual, moral, and religious conversion. The other positions will be positions if they're coherent with the basic positions, counterpositions if they're not. These derivative matters concern, in philosophy, concern metaphysics, ethics, theology, at least philosophical theology, and then in chapter 20 he'll do the opening onto the possibility of revelation and grace. Counterpositions, whether basic or derived, invite reversal because they're incoherent, not necessarily with one another. He says you could dump them all into a computer and it wouldn't break down. So they're not necessarily incoherent with one another, but they're incoherent with the human subject as intelligent and reasonable. With the praxis of grasping and intelligently and affirming and reasoning. Those activities contain the basic positions in act, and that praxis needs only to be objectified to reveal its inconsistency with the counter positions. Positions invite development because they are consistent with those activities, acquiring intelligence, reflecting reason. But those activities will always be incomplete, and so they will always be subject to further completion and so on. But this does mean that significant discoveries can be expressed as counterpositions. The discovery then can be separated out, can be isolated, can be reformulated, and in that way contribute to the clarification of the basic apologetic fact. Examples of what he did with Freud in chapter 6 and with Marx in chapter 7 on group bias. Okay, Marx's genuine insight was group bias. Is an example of the kind of thing that he's talking about. Okay. Yes.
Another clarification in regard to the use of the terms ground and the human mind. The ground of philosophy is the human mind.
Yeah.
And that ground is constituted by the polymorphism of human consciousness. To say that the polymorphism of Dasein. The polymorphism of Dasein is not the same as the polymorphism of human consciousness.
That's true. Dasein is more than
that. Yeah, so what I mean is, if you speak of the ground here, it doesn't seem sufficient to, adequate to just equate it with human mind. So you need to take into consideration what, for instance, when you speak of the received meaning.
Yeah.
It's just much more than the processes.
Well. Okay, but if the received meaning is at that level, okay, of the cognitional theory that he set out. So, the only thing that I would want to add to it to get at Dasein is to add the unconscious and what comes into. Dasein is more than experiencing, understanding, judging, and deciding. It's rather that the tidal movement that Lonergan spoke of, that I quoted in my seminar last week. The tidal movement that begins before consciousness and comes into consciousness through the dream and all the way up through and finds its rest in love. That's, it's all of that. So if he were rewriting the chapter, he'd probably say that the ground is the tidal movement that starts with the molecules in your body. And Phil McShane says, not a twisted thought without a twisted molecule. There's probably some truth to it, but it's the whole thing.
I can appreciate that the ground, the beginning of philosophy is grounded in the possibility of human knowing in terms of its operations, experience, understanding, and judgment.
Mm-hmm.
But what's implicit in that is also a recognition of an anticipation of what precedes it somehow, like psychic conversion.
That's right. No, there's no question. The structure is open. And it's open on both ends, you know. I mean, ultimately, for Lonergan, there were six levels of consciousness in his final unpublished thing, which we put out after we discovered that this. There's the dream, there's experience, understanding, judgment, decision, and religious love. So there's six. And they're open, because the dream is the neural coming into consciousness, and the religious love is open to infinity. The structure is open on both ends. And that's really the ground, is that open tidal movement. He's disengaged one part of it here. This is one stage of his career. He did not yet have, he goes on in chapter 18 to talk about ethics, but he doesn't yet talk about it as a fourth level of consciousness. It's rather an extension of his theory. And only short, by the time he gave the lectures, understanding the being, he had reached a fourth level. It's quite distinct from his levels. So it's not just an extension. But in this book, you'll feel it when you get to chapter 18. It's too narrow. The framework's too narrow. He's not quite there yet. He can talk about ethics, but he doesn't give us... Well, my reading of it is in an Ignatian context. What he's talking about in chapter 18 is a philosophic explanation of St. Ignatius's third mode of making an election, where you weigh the pros and cons rationally and then you choose what is the reasonable way to go. But you can only do that, and Ignatius is very clear on this, you can only do that if you're in a state of equilibrium. And most of the time, none of us is in a state of equilibrium. We're always being torn, pulled one way or another. So we got to read the pulls and counterpulls of affectivity. That's the basis of decisions. So, but Lonergan, and that's Lonergan's way of making decisions in Nestle's theology is effective, not conscious, discrimination, which is Ignatius' second mode. The first mode is being hit by lightning, being St. Paul on the road to Damascus. You have no further questions as to what you are to do. Otherwise, we can pursue those further questions in two ways. Most of the time, it has to be by consolation and desolation and weighing them away from leading us. And that's what that's what Lonergan talks about when he gets to method of theology. He doesn't use that language, but that's what he's talking about. But in insight, he's talking about Ignatius' third one. So anyway, that's just an elaboration that his career was, he was only 50 years old. Almost 30 more years equally productive in terms of change or development on this. So he would agree with you that it's much more because the structure's open on both ends and it's got to be the whole thing that's the ground. That's what adding these two things, for instance, brings that. And then when I gave him the material psychic conversion, he said right away,
but would you say that it is one structure, or is it multiple structures? And what I mean is, let's just take the notion of experience and understanding.
Right.
If there are different ways of experiencing, and the examples would be, let's say, something like sensation versus something like emotion,
right,
the understanding has to be different.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm thinking, is the structure going to repeat itself, but in different ways, let's say for the three modes that Ignatius talks about? Or is it just an expansion of the experience, understanding, judgment?
Well, see, those terms, if I'm understanding your question correctly, I think that this would be at least the beginning of a response to it, but you can tell me whether I'm answering your question or another one. Those terms are very broad heuristic terms, so that experience covers all of them. Understanding covers an understanding of what I've sensed in one case, but in another case, an understanding of what I felt, or of the felt meaning, like the received meanings that I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That
yes.
covers all of those things,
yeah.
but understanding. Judging means, well, you judge whatever the question is asking about. But judgment is a those are very generic and really heuristic.
Yes.
Terms.
But yeah, and I completely agree with you. But still, it seems to me that as a cognitive model, like the way how the brain would actually do it,
mm-hmm.
You need different pathways there, in the sense that judgment has to be different, like the judgment of something that is good and the judgment of something that is true. Those are different.
Oh, those are different. that even in his he's not yet talked about the judgment of anything that's good.
Yes,
that comes with ethics, with value judgments. That's
but it's the same thing with the understanding part. Like the understanding of a sensation is different from the understanding of an emotion.
Yeah, but it still is understanding. It is insight. And that's all he's maintaining. It's not. It's the understanding of a sensation is very different from the understanding of an emotion. Yes, but it still is understanding. And it has something. Those two acts of understanding have something in common.
Yes.
And all acts of judgment have something in common. They are all affirming or denying.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you can't, if you're not ready to, then saying I'm not ready to. They're all that, in some instances. So the neural pathways are going to be different. From the sensation and from the feeling, they probably will be. And the physiologists, neurophysiologists could spell all of that out.
That I'm sure about, but I mean, I'm thinking even metaphorically speaking, they will be different. So I need to think more about it.
Well, that's one of the basic things that he will say, that insight is always and everywhere the same, okay, as an activity. But what it's insight into is going to be different, a myriad different ways, depending on what the data are that you're trying to understand. And to try to understand emotions, for instance, it's going to be as complicated as trying to understand the speed of light.
Well, did you say that at some point in later work that the dream itself was constituting a distinct realm?
In philosophy and the religious phenomenon is the paper. It was written, we have no idea when he wrote it. Fred Crowe hypothesizes 1978 from internal evidence to the paper. It was written for some symposium, but whatever symposium it was, Fred has an idea of what he wrote it for, and then he decided not to use it. And he used something else, or wrote something else for it. So it just was sitting in a file, and we found it. But six levels with the dream is.
And you would have already discussed psychic conversion?
Well, he refers to it. It'll be in the next issue, in the next volume from the collected books, which is at the press right now. Should be like
what's the title?
Philosophy and the Religious Phenomenon. The title of the book is Philosophical and Theological Papers, 1965 to 1980. This is towards the end, obviously, because we have a hypothesis that it was 1978. So, Philosophy and the Religious Phenomenon. But your question is good, because it's not just these. And also on ground, let me say this, that ground, or another term that he uses is principle. And a principle is what is first in any order, or what is first in some order. But a principle does not have to be the first in a logical order. And none of this is logical. It's all intelligent and reasonable, but you couldn't put all of this in a syllogism. You couldn't. He'll have a syllogism later with regard to the method of physics. There are places where the logic is useful, but a lot of this is not principled in that sense. It's rather, as he says in Method and Theology, the principle, intellectual, moral, and religious conversion as foundation or as principle, They're not foundational or principal as a set of propositions, but rather as momentous changes in the subject that the theologian is. That's the ground of everything. It's what has happened to you in your existential participation in trying to meet God and trying to be a decent human being and in trying to figure out what in the world is, trying to make sense of the world that you live in. And there are mammoth changes that can take place, and those are the ground. And those changes don't always take place the way St. Paul's changed, of course. That could take a long time. He speaks of St. Augustine in the throes of a religious conversion that it took him years. And he went from hedonism to Manichaeism to Platonism to the discovery that God loved him. It took a long time to get there. All right, let's pause for a minute.